TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Race, gender, and class struggle. Discussion of racism is usually a discussion about personal attitudes, not of the larger system of power that sustains and feeds institutional and systemic racism and sexism. Racism and sexism have historically served a number of real functions. For example, they have created a surplus workforce, and they have divided those who find themselves at the bottom of the social power structure. In this talk, Michael Parenti asks the important question, how were racism and sexism used by employers, the police, colonial powers, and even the CIA to maintain the existing order? Michael Parenti is an internationally known lecturer and the author of 19 books. He has taught at colleges and universities in the United States and abroad. He gave this lecture in April of 2006 in Arcata, California. Here is Michael Parenti.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Some of us even got in here dry, didn't you? But that's good. We have this trinity of race, gender, and class, and it's sort of treated like a trinity, and I don't want to treat it that way tonight. I think there's nothing wrong with looking at race, gender, and class as distinct from each other, of course, because there are different dynamics, different historical developments, different imperatives involved that are distinct from each other. In many respects, they are. The mistake is to consider these three things as unconnected and always mutually exclusive. In regard to many issues, they are interrelated and part of the same overall systemic dynamic. And I want to start by focusing on class, because there are two ways of looking at class. One way is in race, gender, and class, a demographic trait, like gender is a demographic trait, and race is a demographic trait, and so is class. That means your status, your income, your profession, lifestyle, that sort of thing. There's another way of looking at class, and that's why the title of this talk isn't race, gender, and class. It's race, gender, and class struggle. And that is, class is the only one of the three which you cannot hope for any equality. You can't have classes and have equality. By definition, they're unequal to each other. You can hopefully have and achieve gender equality, which we haven't. You can hopefully achieve racial equality, which we haven't. But you most certainly cannot achieve class equality except by having a classless situation, by eliminating it as the actual dynamic or category. So class is a relationship. It's an interrelationship. You can't have one class without having another. You can't have plutocrats and bourgeois capitalists without having workers and employees. You can't have slaveholders without having slaves. You can't have feudal lords without having serfs. That just about covers all class societies that we've had in history. More than that, the interrelationship involves a relationship to a third factor, which is the material substance and wealth of society, the means of production. One group owns the mines, the factories, the farms, the houses, the land, the newspapers, the media, etc., etc., etc. And the other group has nothing to sell but its labor to the first one. I remember doing backup strike support work in Carbondale, Illinois. I was in Urbana. We went down for one day to Carbondale. And one of the auto worker strikers was African-American, and he put it very succinctly. He said, He said, either you own the mother or you work for it. That was it. Either you own the mother or you work for it. He used a somewhat longer word than mother, but that was it. So, and what we're talking about, when we're talking about ownership and class struggle and class power in this society, we're talking about these gigantic, multi-billion dollar transnational corporations. That's what we're talking about. We're not talking about mom and pop enterprises. I want to make that point because it often comes up in discussions when capitalism is being discussed. There's invariably someone who says, what about the entrepreneurial spirit? What about the mom and pop enterprise, the small business where people struggle and they develop a little business and they hire a few other people and create more jobs? Usually described in that sentimental sing-song voice, is it? And you have more jobs, and then maybe they open up a second little place. And all. And I always answer, I'm not talking about those places. I'm not talking about mom and pop, little businesses. Little businesses isn't what this is about. The wealth, the power, the thrust of it all is very simply in the hands of transnational corporations. Small businesses are the squirrels dancing among the elephants. And squirrels that dance among elephants have a very low life expectancy. And 600 small businesses go under every week in America. And when they go under, unlike Chrysler, unlike Illinois Bank, unlike McDonnell Aircraft, unlike Boeing, unlike any number of other mass multinational corporations, they don't get bailed out. They go under. You're on your own. And they don't count in the power relationship. They count in the economy. In fact, almost all job growth in this economy comes from small businesses, medium-sized businesses, and public service. The net growth in new jobs among the big corporations, of course they're creating new jobs, and that's the Walmarts and McDonald's. But if you count what General Motors is doing, they're closing the factories, the better paid jobs, and outsourcing. You can't bring in their outsourcing and their downsizing and all that stuff. The net number of jobs they create every year is zero. So all that growth comes from middle and small business. So I'm not dismissing small businesses. We're not talking about small capital. We're talking about class struggle and multinational corporate capitalism. Okay, are you with me so far? Okay. We're also talking about wealth. And when you talk about wealth, you should also talk about poverty. Because wealth and poverty not only coexist, there's a dynamic interrelationship between the two of them. We often hear that this is such an unfortunate and juxtaposition. So much wealth and right next to so much poverty. Oh, you go to Rio and you can see all this wealth, these luxury hotels, and right behind them, all those terrible shanty towns. Isn't that terrible? What they don't understand is those shanty towns are supporting that luxury, that wealth creates that poverty. You can't have wealth without poverty. You can't have rich slave owners living in magnificent opulence as they did in the Roman Empire, as I described it in the book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar. You can't have that unless you have slaves who are creating that value and working, and consuming a very small portion of the value they create. That's how we expropriate. That's how we get rich. We take, it's an upward redistribution from those who work to those who don't, for the most part. You can't have lords living in the manor born to the manor born. Well, some of them work, but they're not creating their wealth. I mean, Rupert Murdoch works. He's not creating his billions of dollars. I mean, he can go in his office and be busy. David Rockefeller can go in and be busy if he wants and have three secretaries and all. That's not, he'll walk into here, into this room, and when he leaves, he's richer than when he walked in. He made more money in that time than you made all in a week or a year. Yeah. Well, most of you are unemployed. I can see that already. We're loading the case here. We shouldn't do that. In fairness to poor David Rockefeller. Okay. There's a constant redistribution of wealth from those who produce it to those who own the production facilities. Now, this upward redistribution takes place in other ways, too. I mean, that's the Marxist paradigm, but, you know, that's not all there is to it. For instance, you can say, well, I'm not exploited then because I work for a nonprofit. You know, they're not expropriating my labor in that way. Well, you are, because don't forget you're still a taxpayer and you get terribly exploited that way. One of the greatest sources of profit accumulation is the U.S. Treasury in this country. The return, the most profitable forms of investment are through the U.S. Treasury. You're a pharmaceutical, and you go out there, and you just give $5,000 to this congressman, $5,000 to that one, $10,000 to that senator, another $30,000 to the Republican National Committee, this and that. And they pass a Medicare prescription bill that's going to give your industry $1 trillion in business. That's coming right out of the hides of us taxpayers. That great deficit, that huge deficit that Bush keeps running up, that's an upward redistribution of income from the people who pay the taxes to the people who are lending the money to the government. The government is borrowing money from the people they should be taxing, and they're cutting the taxes of those people. And the greater that deficit goes, the less you get back on your tax dollar. The larger the chunk of that dollar is just going to rich creditors. And that's the whole idea. That's one of the basic ideas behind deficit spending. That's why the conservatives pursue it with such alacrity. Let's discuss racism. Discussions of racism usually fix upon attitudes. Because one of the things American intellectuals do is they manage never to ground anything in material interests or in the social structure as such. Things just float around, and they talk about them, and they write articles about it and all that sort of thing. And we hear that racism is a kind of a bad thing. And we have presidents of the United States. Bill Clinton, in his last year in office, remember he started that thing about, well, I'm going to investigate racism, and he had that highly publicized thing where he sat down with black families and white families and said, now, why can't we all get together and learn to hug and love each other and all that sort of thing? We should keep in mind that it's not just a matter of cleansing hearts and minds. We should keep in mind the larger system of power and interest that sustains racist attitudes. That's why we should speak not only of attitudinal racism, but also of institutional racism and systemic racism. That the system, the structure itself, preordains or feeds and necessitates and is advantaged by these kinds of attitudes. For instance, in modern-day capitalist society, racism and sexism have historically served a number of very real systemic functions. First of all, employers have always desired a surplus workforce. When there's full employment, when jobs are looking for workers rather than workers are looking for jobs, then wages go up. When it's the other way around, when it's workers looking for jobs and there's more workers than jobs, then wages are depressed and they come down. And one way you depress wages and keep them down is by lowering the wage floor, keeping that as low as you can. And what you do there is you try to have a super exploited portion of an already exploited labor pool. The super exploited portion will be made up of disadvantaged people, people who are disadvantaged because of other dynamics maybe in society, like sexism and racism, for instance. And traditionally, this reserve army of labor that helps suppress the labor wages is made up of women, children, immigrants, and ethnic minorities. And what made, in many places, what made that particular group employable, what made women employable in late 19th century industrialization was their quote willingness, I heavily quote willingness because willingness denotes choice almost, but given the horrible necessities, they're forced necessity to go work at a lower wage. If women started demanding the same wages as men did, they'd go and hire men. The other thing it was thought, of course, was that women and children were malleable and less troublesome. They're less likely to throw a wrench in the machine, less likely to punch out the foreman, and immigrants also were more vulnerable. Many of them were illegal. They couldn't voice grievances. Still true. They, with linguistic problems, they couldn't organize that well. Okay. Racism and sexism also serve class power as a divisive force. They help keep the working class fragmented and disorganized, fighting against each other for crumbs rather than concerting for a larger slice of the pie, beating your wife instead of organizing to beat your boss. Economic elites seem well aware of this. They consciously discourage working class unity and they consciously incite inter-ethnic competition. This is an old thing, by the way. This is not some little analysis I'm kind of digging up or making up. You can go back and read Plato and Aristotle. Aristotle, Politics, Book 1, I remember, I think it was. He actually advises the landowner and slaveholders. He said, in your work gangs, meaning your slave gangs, have slaves of different nationalities and different tongues so that they can't understand each other and they are therefore less likely to concert in the pursuit of dangerous novelties, I think was the phrasing in Politics. Let's fast forward from ancient Greece, 400, 500 BC, to the last century, the oil companies and coal mining companies in America. They would deliberately pursue this policy. They'd hire a Swede, a Hungarian, an Italian, a Pole, and have them all work together. They couldn't understand each other. Not that they had read Aristotle, but they were ruling elites who were facing the same opportunities of manipulation and conjuring up divisiveness. In the 1600s in North America, before there were the laws and the ideologies of slavery and racism, before they had been really well developed, you had white indentured servants and black slaves not only worked together, but they lived under the same hard conditions and they fraternized together and sometimes they even intermarried. You know, why did the South and why did the states in this country until as late as what, 1967 was the last miscegenation law finally removed from the books. Why did they have miscegenation laws? They were outlawing intermarriage. Why did they have to actually use the force of the state to outlaw intermarriage? Because people intermarried. It was a problem. They had to teach. They had to teach people racism. They had to instruct them and command them into their racism. It was the same way with anti-Semitism, how it had to be taught to the European peasantry by the lords and bishops of Europe for 1,000 years. You know, though, for years, the peasant had a problem with the demonized Jew. The description didn't fit his friend Moish up the hill, who was a fellow farmer who helped him pull a cow out of the mud and who he worked with. Christians actually attended Jewish ceremonies. Jews actually presided over Christian meetings in the early first millennia. And the peasants had to learn. They learned slowly, but they did learn. And eventually they learned to channelize their legitimate grievances and anger away from their lords and toward irrelevant and innocent enemies. And so we had the same thing in America, where slaveholders and land grabbers endured a lively fear that indentured white servants would join with blacks or Native American Indians against the property class, as happened more than once, by the way. It did happen. Not a very highly publicized part of American history, colonial history. So the colonial governments pursued a conscious policy of creating aversions and segregations between the three racial groups, turning Indians against blacks and poor whites against both. Fast forward again, U.S. prisons back in the 60s, 70s, right down to this day, have consciously promoted friction between white, black, and Latino gangs. Back in the early 70s, I remember a case, I think it was in Oregon or Washington State, I can't remember now, a politically conscious prisoner by the name of Stephen Kessler. All sorts of charges were put on him. He was harassed for his politics and his organizing in the prison. And one of the charges against him was fomenting racial unity in prison. I rest my case. There it is. The same strategies of divide and conquer have been used by urban police forces in regard to street gangs, the Crips and the Bloods in L.A., generations of racial segregation in the U.S. and South Africa have had the effect of setting white workers against black, competing for the scraps off the table. And the more successfully segregated the society, the more successfully suppressed were the unions because of the race issue in the South, the lower were the wages. It's no accident that wages were lowest in the South. It's no accident that unions were weakest in the South. That was the place where this policy of institutionalized racism was pursued with a vigor and a totality that makes your skin crawl. Inciting racial divisiveness has been a standard policy of imperialists for hundreds of years. The North American colonizers and European colonizers of Latin America and Africa and Asia very consistently played off people against people, tribe against tribe, bribing some, giving arms to another, spreading rumors around, creating incidents, murdering some people in one group and blaming it on the people in the other group and the like. The Austro-Hungarian Habsburg Empire played different nationalities against each other. The CIA incited the Hmong tribal people in Vietnam and played on tribal rivalries in Angola, where they supported Zavimbi and his UNITA for 25 years and 2 million deaths in Angola. And the CIA showed a sudden and equally hypocritical compassion for the Mosquito Indians in Nicaragua during the Sandinista reign. Yugoslavia was mentioned. It's a dramatic example of Western intelligence forces egging on and supporting with guns, huge sums of money, and organizational and military assistance, the most retrograde secessionist elements in Croatia. In Croatia, they promoted a leader named Franz Tuđman, who was an out-and-out fascist, who was part of the Ustasi, who were open, total collaborators, Croatian Nazis, who collaborated with the German Nazis in World War II. In Bosnia, they supported Izetbegović. Izetbegović had been in his youth a member of the Hitler SS, the Muslim SS, whose job was bringing and conveying victims of the concentration camps of the Holocaust, including Jews, Serbs, and Roma, known to us as Gypsies, down to the Jasenovac concentration camp, where they were killed under unspeakable conditions. Unspeakable, worse than what the SS did anywhere else. I don't want to go into details. I'm on the advisory board of the Jasenovac Foundation, and there's a literature very poorly circulated, but it's around, and it's a story that needs to be told. These were the people that the U.S. and Bill Clinton and the White House and the media and the CIA were backing. And unfortunately, there were progressives in our own ranks who on this war stood shoulder to shoulder with NATO and the CIA and the White House. The same people who wonder why those rednecks back Bush on Iraq were backing Clinton on Yugoslavia with his 78 days of bombing. And he took a country that was prosperous, where 80% of the economy was publicly owned, and broke that up into a bunch of little right-wing republics now, where everything has been privatized, everything has been deregulated, unemployment is up, the fastest growing profession is prostitution, and the whole economy is being sold off at garage sale prices. Yugoslavia was a self-defining, prosperous, social democracy. It was tolerated during the Cold War when there was a Soviet Union behind it. It no longer had to be tolerated right there in the middle of Europe. It refused to become a client state to corporate globalism. It did not open up its markets to multi-corporate completely. I mean, in Belgrade, and you could see, you know, Hilton Hotel and all that. There was some of that there, but most of the economy was still publicly owned. It refused to join the European Union. It showed no interest in joining NATO, and it was done in. By the way, another group the U.S. supported in that war was the Albanian KLA, which the U.S. State Department had called a terrorist organization just 2 years before. One of the first victims of the KLA were other Albanians who were Federalists who did not want secession and the like. They also pointed out that the KLA was linked to a group called Al-Qaeda and were linked to the Chechnya terrorists. And Kosovo now has been cleansed. It has been cleansed of Serbs, Jews, Gorani, Egyptians, Roma, and all these people.
That was the first part of a one-hour lecture on race, gender, and class struggle by Michael Parenti. With roots in a working-class Italian neighborhood in New York and a PhD in political science from Yale, Michael Parenti has become an internationally known lecturer and author. The Assassination of Julius Caesar, The Culture Struggle, and Super Patriotism are his most recent books. For more information, visit his website at www.michaelparenti.org. You can also visit TUC Radio's website at tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org for a link to Parenti's website. Please find a pen to write down a phone number for information on how to order a CD or audio tape or a film on DVD of this talk. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations. Your order of a copy of this program is our only support and is essential in keeping us on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape or CD or DVD by mail or credit card by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 1-877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.